do it, leading to more guilt. Here are some other dieting examples, which might not be so obvious. Drinking a weight loss beverage for breakfast and lunch, followed by a sensible dinner. Detox fast, which usually consists of some type of liquid fast, in order to remove toxins from your body. Our bodies are built with an amazing inner cleansing system, the liver, kidneys, and digestive system. Colon cleanse, which involves a process forcing the colon to empty its contents, ultimately resulting in diarrhea. The process may be via laxatives, enemas, or colon irrigation, known as a high colonic. Chapter 6. Principle 2. Honor your hunger. Keep your body biologically fed with adequate energy and carbohydrates. Otherwise, you can trigger a primal drive to overeat. Once you reach the moment of excessive hunger, all intentions of moderate, conscious eating are fleeting and irrelevant. Learning to honor this first biological signal sets the stage for rebuilding trust with yourself and food. A dieting body is a starving body. Drastic comparison? No. While a dieting body may not look like a starving person in Ethiopia or Somalia, the symptoms from dieting exhibit a striking resemblance to the starvation state. The body does not know that there is a McDonald's on every corner as you embark on a diet. As far as the body is concerned, it is living in a famine state and adapts. Our need for food, energy, is so essential and primal that if we are not getting enough energy, our bodies naturally compensate with powerful biological and psychological mechanisms. The power of food deprivation was keenly demonstrated in a landmark starvation study conducted by Dr. Ansel Keys during World War II, designed to help famine sufferers. The subjects of the study were 32 healthy men who were selected because they had superior psychobiological stamina, superior mental and physical health. During the first 3 months of the study, the men ate as they pleased, averaging 3,492 calories. The next 6 months was the semi-starvation period. The men were required to lose 19 to 28% of their weight, depending on their body composition. Calories were cut nearly in half to an average 1,570 per day. The effects of the semi-starvation were startling and strikingly mirrored the symptoms of chronic dieting. Metabolic rate decreased 40%. The men were obsessed with food. They had heightened food cravings and talked of food and collecting recipes. Eating style changed, vacillating from ravenously gulping to stalling out the eating experience. Some men played with their food and dawdled over a meal for 2 hours. The researchers noted that several men failed to adhere to their diets and reported episodes of bulimia. One man was reported to have suffered a complete loss of willpower and ate several cookies, a sack of popcorn, and 2 bananas. Another subject flagrantly broke the dietary rules and ate several sundaes, malted milks, and even stole penny candy. Some men exercised deliberately to obtain increased food rations. Personalities changed, and in many cases there was the onset of apathy, irritability, moodiness, and depression. During the refeeding period, when the men were once again allowed to eat at will, hunger pangs became more intense, and hunger was insatiable. The men found it difficult to stop eating. Weekend binges added up to 8,000 to 10,000 calories. It took the majority of men an average of 5 months to normalize their eating. It's important to remember that during the era of this classic study, there were no celebrity trainers, the TV Food Network, or fitness and food divas. Nutrition research was just in its infancy. Yet these men experienced a primal obsession with food that was not media-driven or society-driven. Rather, it was triggered by a biological survival mechanism. Such behavior was never observed in these men prior to their food deprivation encounter. Although this is a classic starvation study, the caloric level is representative of a modern weight loss diet for men of 1,500 calories. These men were eating 1,500 calories worth of food and still experienced marked symptoms, both physically and psychologically. Imagine if the same study was held under today's pressures to be thin. We have had several clients read the classic Keyes study, and they are struck by their own similar experiences to the semi-starved men. Mary, for example, noted that after completing her second liquid fast program, she was more obsessed with food than ever before. She bought several cookbooks and major cooking appliances, a waffle maker, a bread maker, and a food processor. The biggest paradox, Mary noted, was that she doesn't like to cook and did not use her new appliances or cookbooks. Jan had dieted most of her life, but the more she dieted, the more she got interested in food. She collected magazine and newspaper recipes of all kinds, from rich gourmet to Spartan spa cuisine, and read them as if they were engaging novels. Yet she would never dare prepare the scrumptious recipes. Instead, they were her food fantasy and food escapism. Of mice and men, rats are certainly not exposed to the social pressures and nuances of eating that humans are, yet when deprived of food, rats will also overeat. In one study, rats were divided into two groups, one food-deprived and one control group. The food-deprived rats went without food for up to 4 days, and then were allowed to eat again until they gained their weight back. Both groups of rats were then given free access to a palatable diet, beyond the ordinary rat chow staples, like five-star dining in the rodent world. While both groups gained weight, those in the food-deprived group gained more weight in direct proportion to the length of their prior deprivation. Primal hunger. The psychological terror of hunger is profound, notes Naomi Wolf in her book, The Beauty Myth. Even after hunger has ended, the nagging terror of it remains. She cites how hungry orphans adopted from poor countries often cannot control their compulsion to smuggle and hide food, even after living for years in a secure environment. A disproportionate number of starving concentration camp survivors are now obese. Research historians have documented that during times of famine or food shortages, food becomes an overriding preoccupation, resulting in societal problems, breakdown of social behavior, abandonment of cooperative effort, loss of personal pride and sense of family ties. While this preoccupation with food hasn't been observed during times of food deprivation, these actions also mirror dieting behavior at the individual level. How often have you become more socially isolated while on a diet? Turning down a party invitation, for instance, because you didn't want to deal with the food, or not going out altogether until you are through with your diet. While the hunger and food obsession from dieting may not be experienced as a terrifying event, it does leave a lasting mark. Karen had been on several medically supervised fasts over her lifetime and became frightened of experiencing hunger. To her, hunger was terrifying and often resulted in out-of-control eating, which reinforced her fear of hunger. Therefore, Karen always kept herself in a fed state between diets, never to really experience gentle biological hunger. She only knew what extreme hunger felt like with all of its voracious intensity. To avoid hunger, she was constantly eating. But the persistent eating caused more weight gain, so she would start a new diet or fasting program, and the vicious cycle would continue. Hunger from dieting, followed by overeating. Mechanisms that trigger eating. Whether or not you are a chronic dieter, powerful biological mechanisms are triggered when your body does not get the energy from food that it needs. It's no accident that food is included as one of the fundamental needs in Maslow's hierarchy of needs, a model that ranks human needs, suggesting that certain basic needs must be met before you can go on to fulfill more complex ones. Food and energy are so essential to the survival of the human species that if we don't eat enough, we set off a biological fuse that turns on our eating drive, both physically and psychologically. The hunger drive is truly a mind-body connection. Eating is so important that the nerve cells of appetite are located in the hypothalamus region of the brain. A variety of biological signals triggers eating. What many people believe to be an issue of willpower is instead a biological drive. The power and intensity of the biological eating drive should not be underestimated. The neurochemicals from the brain coordinate our eating behavior with our body's biological need. Through a complex system of chemical and neural feedback, the brain monitors the energy needs of all our body systems moment to moment. And it makes very emphatic chemical directives as to what we should eat. Fasting or restricting is particularly counterproductive to appetite. It simply turns on the neurochemical switches that induce us to eat. Many studies have shown that lowering body weight by food restriction and dieting makes no sense metabolically or to our brain chemistry. In fact, it's counterproductive. The biological chemicals that regulate appetite also directly affect moods and state of mind, our physical energy, and our sex lives. Most researchers agree that there are both complex biological and psychological mechanisms that influence our eating. In this chapter, we will focus on the profound biological mechanisms that turn on our desire to eat, especially if we have been food-deprived or dieting. Heightened digestion. In food-deprived individuals, research has shown that the body gets biologically primed for the moment of eating, like a sprinter, crouched in a ready position for an explosive start, the moment the starting pistol is triggered. Salivation increases with increases of food deprivation, even when there is no food present or suggestion of eating. This has been demonstrated in studies both on dieters and normal, non-dieting individuals. Increased digestive hormones have been found in dieters both before and after eating. The carbohydrate craver, neuropeptide Y. Neuropeptide Y, NPY, is a chemical produced by the brain that triggers our drive to eat carbohydrates, the body's primary and preferred source of energy. While most of what we know about NPY comes from research on rats, there is a lot of evidence that shows that this brain chemical can have a profound impact on human eating behavior as well, by increasing both the size and duration of carbohydrate-rich meals. Food deprivation or under-eating drives NPY into action, causing the body to seek more carbohydrates. When the next meal or eating opportunity rolls around, it can easily turn into a high-carbohydrate binge. Not because you lack willpower or are out of control. It's your biology. Rather, NPY screaming, "Feed me!" NPY is revved up after any imposed period of food deprivation, including an overnight fast from dinner to breakfast. NPY's levels are naturally the highest in the morning because of the short-term food deprivation from an overnight fast. The elevated NPY levels are part of the biological basis for eating in the morning. During an overnight fast, your body's stores of carbohydrate in the liver are drained and need refilling. You literally wake up on empty in the morning. But if you skip breakfast, you are likely to pay for it with increases in NPY levels, which can lead to mid-afternoon gorging. The brain also makes more NPY when carbohydrates are being burned as fuel and under times of stress. Eating carbohydrates turns off NPY through its effect on serotonin, another brain chemical. As we eat more carbohydrates, it helps to increase the production of serotonin, which in turn shuts off the production of NPY and puts a halt to the desire for carbohydrates. The more you deny your true hunger and fight your natural biology, the stronger and more intense food cravings and obsessions become. Fasting or restricting especially revs up the NPY and drives the body to seek more carbohydrates. So by the time the next eating opportunity occurs, it can easily become a high-carbohydrate binge. Why is there such a chemical drive for carbohydrates? Let's look briefly at the critical role carbohydrates play in the body. It will help you understand the primal hunger drive. The importance of carbohydrates. Carbohydrates are the gold standard of food energy to the body. Cells function best when they receive a certain level of carbohydrates in the form of glucose, and even small decreases can cause problems. The brain, nervous system, and red blood cells rely exclusively on glucose for fuel. Because of the importance of glucose, the levels of it in the blood are closely regulated by two hormones, insulin and glucagon. There's a very limited amount of carbohydrate stored in the liver in the form of glycogen that helps supply more glucose to the blood when levels get too low. Yet this precious fuel reserve ordinarily lasts only 3 to 6 hours, except at night, when liver glycogen lasts longer because the need for energy is lower. How does it get replaced? Eating. Eating carbohydrate-rich foods, that is. If carbohydrates are inadequate in the diet, the body has to turn to creative fueling mechanisms to supply vital energy to the body. Protein, mainly from muscle, would get taken apart and converted to energy, primarily in the form of glucose. It's like taking wood from the framework structure in your house to use as fuel in your fireplace. The wood will burn and provide necessary fuel, but it does so at a high price. You begin to lose the integrity of your structure. If you think that eating a high-protein diet will prevent this dismantling from occurring, it's not so. When you eat an inadequate amount of energy or carbohydrates, the protein from the diet will also be diverted to be used as energy. Therefore, this high-protein diet is no insurance. Instead, the protein is used as an expensive source of fuel, rather than for its intended use in the body. It's like having a building supplier provide lots of wood to rebuild your house. If you are constantly using that wood pile to make bonfires instead of repairing your home, you are still left with a weak structure. Similarly, protein is needed to maintain and build muscles, hormones, enzymes, and cells in the body. When carbohydrates and energy are lacking, protein is shifted from its primary role to provide fuel. Many of our clients believe that when we don't have enough energy, our bodies will finally start burning fat. It doesn't work that way. Remember, the brain and other parts of the body need carbohydrates exclusively for fuel. Only a very small component, 5% of the stored fat, can be converted to a carbohydrate fuel. On the other hand, the body has plenty of enzymes to convert protein to glucose. One reason people lose weight so quickly on low-carbohydrate or fasting diets is that they are devouring their own protein tissues as fuel. Since protein contains only half as many calories per pound as fat, it disappears twice as fast. Also, with each pound of body protein, 3 or 4 pounds of associated water are lost. If your body were to continue to consume itself at this rate, death would occur within about 10 days. After all, the liver, heart muscle, and lung tissue, all vital tissues, are being burned as fuel. Even when the heart muscle is deteriorating, it still has to keep up the same amount of work, with less power and at a slower heart rate. In essence, the cannibalized heart muscle has to work harder with a smaller, faulty engine. Pumping performance is not reduced in proportion to the amount of heart tissue lost. Eventually, the body can convert stored fat to a usable energy form for the brain and nervous system, called ketones. This is known as ketosis. Ketosis is an adaptation to prolonged fasting or carbohydrate deprivation. But only about half of the brain's cells can use these compounds for energy. Therefore, when fat is being used under these deprivation conditions, the body's lean tissue, protein, continues to be lost at a rapid rate in order to supply glucose to nervous system cells that cannot use ketones as fuel. The bottom line? Adequate carbohydrates and energy are important. The powerhouse cell theory. Hunger signals are not affected by low carbohydrates alone. According to the work of cellular researchers Nicolaitis and Even, the hunger signal is generated by the overall energy need of the cell. When cellular power is low, it will produce a signal that induces hunger. While cells primarily get their energy from carbohydrates, protein and fat are factored into the cellular power equation, which could trigger hunger. For example, even if one of your household appliances runs on pure electricity, it could also get its energy from batteries or a gasoline-powered generator. They all provide energy but have different costs and efficiencies. All nutrients that provide energy, carbohydrates, protein, and fat, eventually get converted to one universal energy denomination used by the cell, ATP. ATP is the chemical energy that powers the cells and thus our bodies. Nicolaitis and Even propose that the hunger signal is triggered by the overall ATP need of the cell. To sum up, we need energy. Energy comes from food. Second-guessing your biology. In spite of the complex and elegant biological systems that help ensure that our bodies get enough energy, food, all too often the chronic dieter tries to outthink biology. Rather than eating when hungry, eating is often tied into a cognitive set point based on the dieter's set of rules. Is it time? Do I deserve it? Is it fat-free? And so forth. For example, on the days Alice exercised early in the morning, she would get mad at herself for eating a larger but appropriate breakfast. She was worried that her body did not deserve the extra portion of food, so her solution was to skip lunch. Skipping lunch was easy because Alice was a busy executive assistant with never enough hours in the day to get her work done. Her busyness preoccupied any afternoon hunger that would surface. But by the time Alice arrived at home in the evening, she would be so hungry she would overeat at dinner and often late into the night. Or if she were eating out at a restaurant, she would devour the breadbasket and clean her plate, feeling stuffed and guilty by the end of her meal. Even non-dieters who go too long without eating will often overeat. Remember, even rats overeat when food-deprived. You are also likely to buy more food impulsively when you are in a ravenous state, regardless of your health and dieting intentions. The problem with consistently denying your hunger state is twofold. First, it usually crescendos into a period of overeating. Second, when the mind gets so used to ignoring hunger signals, they begin to fade and you don't hear them anymore. Or you can only hear hunger in extreme, ravenous states, which can be adverse. This further conditions you to believe that you can't be trusted with food, because ravenous hunger often triggers overeating. This is explained in part by the boundary model for the regulation of eating, developed by C. Peter Herman and Janet Polivy, psychological experts in chronic dieting. This model considers both the biology and psychology of eating. The boundary model explains how dieters, through their cognitive set point, push their normal biological cues of hunger and satiety to the extremes. The gentle sensations of hunger are atrophied for a dieter who is constantly trying to suppress them. Instead, the dieter might only feel extreme, ravenous hunger, or be so disconnected that the feeling of hunger is difficult to identify. Similarly, for this individual, it can be increasingly difficult to know what comfortable satiety feels like. Instead, the dieter hovers in a gray zone of what Herman and Polivy call biological indifference. In the zone of biological indifference, there is no clear hunger or satiety cue. This zone is so wide for the chronic dieter that instead of eating based on internal eating cues, food thoughts and judgments prevail and tell the dieter what to do. Primal food therapy. Honor your hunger. The first step to reclaiming the world of normal eating, free of dieting and food worry, is to honor your biological hunger. Your body needs to know consistently that it will have access to food, that dieting and deprivation have halted, once and for all. Otherwise, your biology will always be on call, ready to avert a self-imposed food deprivation. Your body needs to be biologically reconditioned. Diet after diet has taught your body that personal famines are frequent, so it should stay on guard. Remember, famines and food shortages have always existed, even in our modern times. Our bodies are still biologically equipped to survive famines through lowering our energy requirements, increasing biological chemicals that trigger our eating drive, and so on. It is much easier to stop eating when you truly know you will be able to eat again. For example, imagine you are in a room and offer a starving child a plate of cookies. You tell the child that she can have only one cookie. You exit the room and leave the child alone with a whole plate. What would the hungry child do? Eat all the cookies and lick the crumbs, of course. But if the child knew that cookies or any other food were always available when hungry, the intensity to eat would be greatly diminished. The same is true for dieters. For example, Barbara usually kept herself in a hungry state. She only allowed herself to eat when extremely ravenous. By her own definition, if she allowed herself to eat when simply hungry but not ravenous, she thought she was overeating. Yet because her definition of normal hunger was being ravenous, her eating would vacillate from feast to famine cycles. Hunger silence. What if you don't feel hunger anymore, or never really knew what the gentle sensation of hunger feels like? Can you get it back? Yes. But first, let's look at a couple of reasons why hunger may be silenced. Numbing. Many people have learned over the years to quell or avert hunger pangs by turning to calorie-free beverages, such as diet sodas, coffee, and tea. The liquid in the stomach temporarily tricks the gastric mechanism into a sense of fullness. Dieting. Dieters get so used to denying their hunger that it becomes easy to tune it out. Eventually, when hunger comes knocking on their inner door and there is no response, the knocking, or rather the stomach rumbling, stops. Chaos. It's very easy to suppress hunger or ignore it when you are busy putting out the fires in your life or job. If this is a chronic pattern, hunger may slowly fade. Skipping breakfast. Some of our clients skip eating in the morning because they say it keeps them from feeling hungrier the rest of the day. Yet hunger is a normal, welcomed body signal that should be embraced. It's a sign that you are getting back in touch with your body's needs. But because these clients are afraid of their hunger, especially when it becomes overwhelming in the evening as a result of not eating early in the day, they respond by not eating breakfast the next morning, which repeats the vicious cycle of hunger silence. How to honor biological hunger. It's too hard to hear hunger if you are never listening for it. The first step to honoring your biological hunger is to begin to listen for it. The symphony of hunger has many sounds that are varied for different people. Just as an orchestra conductor can distinguish the voices of each instrument in a symphony, you will eventually be able to key in to specific bodily sensations and what they mean. In the beginning, you may be able to recognize overt, ravenous hunger, but have difficulty recognizing gentle hunger pangs. Similarly to the non-trained musical ear, loud cymbals might be easy to identify, but it will take time and listening to pick up on the subtler voices of the bassoon or oboe. Each time you eat, ask yourself, am I hungry? What's my hunger level? If the feeling of hunger is hard to identify, ask yourself, when was the last time I ever felt hungry? How did my stomach feel? How did my mouth feel? Any combination of the following can be experienced as hunger sensations or symptoms, ranging from gentle to ravenous. Mild gurgling or gnawing in the stomach, growling noises, lightheadedness, difficulty concentrating, uncomfortable stomach pain, irritability, feeling faint, headache. The ebb and flow of your hunger might not match other people's. That's okay, it's individual. Take care not to get overly hungry or ravenous. If this is difficult for you to gauge, a general guideline is to go no longer than 5 waking hours without eating. This is based on the biology of fueling up your carbohydrate tank in the liver, which runs out every 3 to 6 hours. We have observed that clients who go longer than 5 hours without eating tend to overeat at the next eating opportunity. For some people, this can happen even after 3 or 4 hours without eating. To get in touch with the nuances of hunger, it helps to check the pulse of hunger at regular intervals. Check in with your body and simply inquire, "What's my hunger level?" It's helpful to do this every time you eat and between eating occurrences. Remember, although this may seem hyperconscious, it's a focused step to get you reacquainted with your body and its biology. We have used a variety of tools to help our clients check in with their hunger, but one is particularly helpful and is a little less exacting. Monitor your hunger levels each time you eat, before and after. What pattern do you see emerging? Is there a certain time interval that you eat? Is there any relationship between how much you eat and the length of time between eating? You may discover that your eating style leans toward nibbling or grazing. Don't be alarmed. If you eat small amounts of food, such as a snack or mini-meal, you may find that you are hungry more often, such as every 2, 3, or 4 hours. Not only is this normal, it may have metabolic advantages. Nibbling studies, in which people are given multiple snacks or mini-meals, have shown that the release of insulin is lower in people fed nibbling diets compared to larger traditional meals of identical calories. Insulin is a fat-building hormone. The more insulin released, the easier it is for the body to make fat. Sometimes our clients get worried when they suddenly feel more hungry than usual, as if something is wrong. However, on closer inspection, they usually find that a couple of days prior, they had an unusually light day of eating. Not dieting, but just not a lot of food. The body plays catch-up on its own terms, not yours. Most of our clients have difficulty remembering what they ate one day ago, let alone 2 days ago. Research on children has shown that they make up for their needs in an average of time, such as a week or a couple of days. Why would adults be any different? In fact, new research is beginning to indicate the same is true for adults. The body may do some of its energy fine-tuning over a period of days, rather than from hour to hour. We find this is especially true if you have a tendency to eat diet types of food, such as rice cakes or salad. You may feel full, but the lack of energy catches up with you. The body wants to compensate. Other voices of hunger. A common mistake with our newer clients is that they initially embrace the honor your hunger concept in the form of a diet mantra, "Thou shalt eat only when hungry." The problem here is that this rigid interpretation can leave you feeling as if you have broken a rule or failed if you eat for any other reason than hunger. When you feel like you have broken a rule, you get pulled right back into the diet mentality. Taste hunger. Sometimes people may eat simply because it sounds good or because the occasion calls for it. We call this taste hunger. Normal eaters can accept this. They don't view it as a big diet violation. In nearly every culture, food plays important roles in rites of passage and celebratory events. Would you chastise a bride or groom for eating a piece of wedding cake when she or he was not hungry? Yet it's not unusual for dieters to feel bad about any perceived food transgression, and then feel like they might as well throw in the towel. And that's when overeating often takes place. Practical hunger. Planning ahead. While it's important to eat primarily based on your biological hunger, it's also important to be practical and not rigid. For instance, let's say you are attending a play with friends that lasts from 7 to 10 p.m., and your opportunity to eat out is at 6 p.m. You may not be hungry then, but you certainly will be later. Do you sit there at the restaurant and not eat, and let hunger roll in right in the middle of the play, only to culminate in ravenous hunger by the final act? No. Eating a light meal or snack is a sensible solution. Emotional hunger. Once you are truly able to identify and distinguish biological hunger, it becomes easier to clarify why you want to eat. It is not unusual for a number of our clients to eat because of emotional hunger, to quench uncomfortable feelings, such as loneliness, boredom, and anger. Ironically, many of our patients are often amazed that what they assume to be emotional eating was, in many instances, primal hunger eating. But the out-of-control feeling of eating is nearly identical, whether it was triggered emotionally or biologically. A discussion of how to distinguish the sources of hunger is found in Chapter 11. Studies show eating in response to initial hunger improves health and weight. A promising series of studies from an Italian research team in Florence shows that training people to recognize initial hunger improves insulin sensitivity and lowers body mass index. They were able to train people to predict when blood glucose is low by attending to their subjective experience of hunger. There are two unique aspects to their approach. First, the focus of the training is distinguishing initial hunger from the uncomfortable symptoms that occur when hunger is prolonged. Secondly, a biofeedback technique, well known to diabetic educators, was utilized to train people how to make this distinction via blood glucose monitoring, using glucometers. Note, these people did not have diabetes or impaired glucose tolerance. Initially, people were instructed to measure their blood sugar at the earliest feelings of hunger or discomfort. Next, if glucose was under 85 milligrams per deciliter, subjects were instructed to remember their physical feelings and to proceed to eat their meal. Note, the glucose level of 85 milligrams per deciliter was chosen based on previous studies, indicating that it represents the upper limit of homeostatic control of feeding. If blood sugar was higher than 85 milligrams per deciliter, subjects were instructed to delay the meal. They were then asked to wait for the spontaneous development of novel hunger feelings for at least 1 hour before making further blood glucose measurements. Two other studies using this initial hunger recognition technique demonstrated that people trained in this method had improved insulin sensitivity and weight loss compared to the non-trained controls. When insulin is less effective in your body, it is called insulin resistance, which is related to chronic health problems. The research team concluded that restoring and validating hunger and training people to recognize initial hunger could help in the prevention and treatment of diabetes and obesity and associated disorders. Chapter 7. Principle 3. Make peace with food. Call a truce. Stop the food fight. Give yourself unconditional permission to eat. If you tell yourself that you can't or shouldn't have a particular food, it can lead to intense feelings of deprivation that build into uncontrollable cravings and often binging. When you finally give in to your forbidden foods, eating will be experienced with such intensity, it usually results in Last Supper overeating and overwhelming guilt. When I was on the grapefruit diet, all I wanted was bananas. And when I was on a low-carbohydrate diet, all I did was dream of eating bread and potatoes, said Lori, an inveterate dieter. Does that sound ironic? Familiar? What may seem like irony is actually the natural reaction that is triggered by the limitation and deprivation that comes with most diets. Cravings run rampant as soon as we're restricted from any kind of substance, whether it is clothing, fresh air, scenery, or especially food. Scientists living in the Biosphere 2, an airtight glass-enclosed terrarium, coveted something as basic as fresh air after being deprived of an open environment for 2 years. But fresh air was not the only fantasy of these researchers. So, too, was the food they had sorely missed. After they emerged from this self-imposed captivity, the research team had more to say about food than science at their press conference. The scientists described cravings for food that began to occupy their thoughts and led one of them to write a cookbook. These scientists are not unlike the dieter who has been told certain foods are forbidden. Even though they were not on a diet, the scientists were still preoccupied with food cravings as a result of lack of availability. They dreamed about desserts which were non-existent and obsessed about dinners which were of limited variety. As cooking chores rotated, it became vitally important not to spoil the day's meal for the others. Common foods like salmon, berries, and coffee took on a heightened allure. The deprivation setup. Why would biosphere scientists, or the healthy men in the Ansel Keys study, described in the previous chapter, exhibit behaviors so unlike their normal eating patterns? Deprivation. These people had not been tainted by the dieting trap, yet their reactions to deprivation were virtually identical to those of dieters. While you have already seen the effects of biological deprivation in the last chapter, you should not underestimate the psychological effect of deprivation. This effect is the focus of this chapter. When you rigidly limit the amount of food you are allowed to eat, it usually sets you up to crave larger quantities of that very food. In fact, being restricted from anything in life sets it up to be extra special, regardless of age. Oh, maybe not in the beginning, when you are in the initial stages of diet euphoria. But the craving builds with each dieting day. For example, if you put a 2-year-old on the floor with several brand new toys and tell him that he can play with any one of them except for the simple oatmeal carton, which do you think he'll choose? You guessed it, the plain oatmeal carton. One client revealed that when he was young, he had little money, and the thought of buying a new car gave him a deep thrill. Yet now that he's successful, he can buy any car he wants at any time. Cars are no longer a big deal, no thrill. Food has replaced the thrill that buying a new car used to provide. Paradoxically, food is the one thing out of his reach, forbidden when dieting. The forbidden object is elevated to an overvalued level of specialness. Psychologist Fritz Heider stated that depriving yourself of something you want can actually heighten your desire for that very item. The moment you banish a food, it paradoxically builds up a craving life of its own that gets stronger with each diet and builds more momentum as the deprivation deepens. Deprivation is a powerful experience, both biologically and psychologically. You already saw in the last chapter how food deprivation sets off a biological drive. Psychological forces wreak havoc with your peace of mind, triggering cravings, obsessive thoughts, and even compulsive behaviors. When a diet dictates that a particular food is forbidden or should be avoided, it makes you crave that food even more. If you are someone who has experienced deprivation in areas outside of food, such as love, attention, material wants, etc., the deprivation connected to dieting may be felt even more intensely by you. Bonnie is a client who grew up in a home where her father was never home and her mother was emotionally distant. As a young child, she learned to use food as a way to substitute for the love and attention she wasn't getting. As an adult on a diet, she found that food deprivation evoked these deep feelings of deprivation from childhood. For Bonnie, this became a double whammy, which was hard to overcome. For the chronic dieter, the combination of biological changes from under-eating, psychological reactions, and cognitive distortions create just the right mix to set off the dynamite of rebound eating. Deprivation backlash. Rebound eating. Meet Heidi. Her experience with chocolate typifies what can happen when you deprive yourself of a particular food. Heidi had been on every known diet, each forbidding one type of food or another, and chocolate was usually on the do not eat list. Heidi was a self-described chocoholic. She complained that the moment chocolate crossed her lips, she couldn't stop eating it. Her way of managing her chocolate problem was simply to not allow herself to eat it. But this was a vicious cycle. It was not uncommon for Heidi to consume large bags of chocolate, in spite of her attempts to eliminate it from her life. The moment a box of chocolate was opened, she couldn't resist eating it to completion. Heidi's chocolate binges were triggered by the food rule she had created: I am not allowed to eat chocolate. This meant that each time she succumbed and ate it, she truly believed that it was for the last time. Each chocolate episode would become a farewell to chocolate, with all the sadness and mourning that goes along with saying goodbye to anything special in life. Since Heidi knew she was never ever going to eat chocolate again, despite her experience demonstrating otherwise, she would consume large amounts of it as a last hurrah, or get it while you can. When Heidi's chocolate binges occurred, she would feel guilty, and as if she did not deserve to eat any food. She would compensate for her chocolate feasts by under-eating or semi-fasting, which would set her up for ravenous hunger and more out-of-control eating. Today, Heidi eats chocolate, but is often satisfied with a piece or two, and can easily even pass it up. To Heidi, this is a miracle. How did she overcome her chocolate problem? Heidi's solution was to learn to make peace with food, especially with chocolate, an idea that she was terrified to try in the beginning. No wonder. Her only experience with chocolate was eating it in massive quantities, then feeling out of control. For Heidi, making peace with chocolate was a brave and risky step. Last Supper eating. The mere perception that food might become banned can trigger overeating. Just thinking about going on a diet can create a sense of panic and send you on a trail of eating every food that you think won't be allowed. As we explained in Chapter 1, this is Last Supper eating. It is triggered by the sincere belief that you will never get to eat a particular food or foods again. The threat of deprivation becomes so powerful that all reason is lost, and you find yourself eating whatever is to be forbidden, even if you are not hungry. Clients will often overeat right before their first session. Although we make it clear that we use a non-dieting approach, they figure that we have something up our sleeves, a diet of sorts. After all, we are both registered dietitians and nutrition therapists. For example, Paul ate in an out-of-control fashion the night before his first appointment. Why? Paul was sure that he would be advised to give up most of his favorite foods and to start eating a diet of carrots and cottage cheese. His fear increased during the week leading up to his session, and so did his intake of French fries, hamburgers, and donuts. This experience was not new to Paul. In fact, he had engaged in Last Supper eating before every diet he started. Likewise, nearly all of our clients engage in this pre-dieting ritual of saying goodbye to favorite foods. In fact, some of our clients tell us that Last Supper eating is one of their favorite parts of dieting. It's almost an entitlement. For some of our clients, however, there is such an intense sense of urgency with Last Supper eating that a period of frantic gorging ensues. One client described it as, "Hurry and get all the food while you can, and time is short, so get it all now." The overeating that follows falsely gives proof that you need to diet, as you watch in horror your inability to control yourself. Each impending diet brings with it more fear of deprivation, with the knowledge that you won't get enough or get what you want. Then comes more overeating, loss of self-control, and finally erosion of self-esteem. How could you possibly feel good about yourself if you truly believe that it's possible to eliminate certain foods, only to find yourself binging and failing on yet another diet? Rebound eating. Subtle forms. Food competition. Have you ever shared a bowl of cherries or a piece of dessert with someone who eats faster than you? Watch how quickly you dig in, because you're concerned that you won't get enough. Or see what happens when you hear that your favorite brand of cereal is to be discontinued. It's not unusual to buy every last box on the shelf because of fear of deprivation. Or some parents find themselves gobbling down the cookies before the kids can get their hands on them and eat them all. Eating in a large group of people can instill a sense of future food deprivation worry. To prevent this from occurring, there is a tendency to eat quickly, grab it while you can, or there won't be any food left. For example, Joshua was one of 9 children in a family of moderate means. As a child, he was worried that he wouldn't get enough food at mealtime, although in actuality there was an adequate amount of food to go around. While not overweight as a child, the fear of food deprivation taught him to grab what he could. As an adult, he continued this behavior, which evolved into an obesity problem. Returning home syndrome. When they return from having been away, people often overeat because they felt deprived of familiar foods while away. Kids returning home from summer camp or from their college dorms find themselves emptying the refrigerator, gorging on home cooking, or visiting their favorite local restaurants excessively. Recently, I came home to find my stepson's friend, who had just returned from Thailand, methodically eating everything in the kitchen that he hadn't seen in 3 years. When he began to eat the cream cheese by the forkful, without a bagel, I knew how deprived he had been. Even fresh fruits and vegetables take on a heightened allure when one is returning from a journey in which they were not available. For example, clients have described unusual cravings for salads after a 2-week camping trip or trip abroad, where it's been advised not to eat the fresh produce. The empty cupboard. If there is consistently no food in the house because grocery shopping is chaotic, eating often vacillates between feast and famine, with emphasis on the former. Food in the pantry or refrigerator takes on extra specialness. For example, Gail is a young woman who exhibits a tendency to eat every bite of food in a meal, regardless of how stuffed she feels. Gail's parents work many hours, seldom shop for food, and eat most of their meals out. Gail usually comes home from school to an empty house, no food, or parents. With food haphazardly available, Gail feels greatly deprived. She feels a compulsion to finish whatever food she gets, as she doesn't know where or when her next meal will appear. Captivity behavior. Various accounts of released hostages have reported obsessive thinking about food and cravings while in captivity. On a somewhat lighter level, my son described his captivity behavior during a survival training camp out in the wilderness in Montana. To occupy his lonely hours, he would write lists of all the foods he wasn't getting. Yet normally he is not preoccupied with food or cravings. Depression-era eating. People who went through the Great American Depression hold food in special regard. It's cherished. There is a pervasive sense that there won't be enough food, or certain foods may become unavailable. And like a precious metal, you dare not throw food away, let alone waste it. Clean your plate takes on special meaning and is passed on with other family traditions and values. Once in a lifetime. Eating a meal in a special restaurant while on vacation can stimulate a sense of future deprivation. For example, if you are in Paris, eating a superb French meal, the thought of leaving even a forkful seems an impossible feat. After all, this is likely to be the one and only time you'll ever experience these particular tastes in this particular setting. You might eat until uncomfortably full, just because you're already feeling deprived. One last shot. A similar experience can occur when eating a delicious meal at the home of a friend, or tasting cookies that have been sent as a gift. The notion that this is your only shot at these foods drives you to eat every last bit of the meal or food. How is dieting possible? If deprivation backlash is so powerful, how do dieters actually diet at all? Aren't the biological and psychological forces too compelling? Chronic dieters adapt by changing both their mindset and their responsiveness to inner body cues. This adaptation is known as restrained eating. Unfortunately, these changes work against them. In the long run, deprivation backlash still prevails. Restrained eaters, in essence, are chronic dieters who are preoccupied with dieting and weight control. To stay in control with their food, restrained eaters set up rules that dictate how they should eat, rather than listening to their bodies. Forget honor your hunger. Instead, they calculate what to eat, choosing foods with their mental brakes on, and second-guessing the needs of their bodies. Their eating appears to be fine, until one of their sacred rules is violated. When a rule is broken, so is their restraint, and wham, overeating begins. This has been described as the what-the-hell effect by leading researchers in this field, Janet Polivy, Ph.D., and C. Peter Herman, Ph.D., from the University of Toronto. And it is that phrase, rather than the term restrained eating, that most of our clients relate to. Here's what it means in eating terms. The moment a forbidden food is eaten, overeating takes place. The moment a calorie level is exceeded, overeating takes place. The mere perception of breaking a food rule or eating a forbidden fruit triggers overeating. Restrained eating studies. Studies on restrained eaters have shed a lot of psychological light on the world of dieting. They show how ineffective outlawing particular foods can be, and how it sets you up for overeating. Most restraint studies follow this core procedure. A short 10-question test, called the restraint scale, is given to identify who the restrained eaters are. Questions include frequency of dieting, history of weight loss and gain, weekly weight fluctuations, emotional effect of weight fluctuations, effect of others on eating, obsessive thinking about food, and guilt feelings about eating. Then a preload is given. That is, the subjects are loaded up with food before the real experiment begins. The preload is a calculated amount of food, and it's usually some sort of setup to see how the dieters versus non-dieters respond in various eating situations. Then the real experiment begins. Here are a couple of particularly significant studies on restrained eaters. Mind games. The counter-regulation effect. One of the classic studies involved 57 female college students at Northwestern University. The students were led to believe that the goal of the study was to evaluate the taste of several ice cream samples. The actual purpose of the study was to determine how diet thinking might affect eating after drinking milkshakes. The women were arbitrarily divided.